أعوذ بالله من الشيطان الرجيم بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم ربي اشرح لي صدري ويسر لي أمري واحلل عقدة من لساني يفقهوا قولي. My dear elders, brothers and sisters, Salamun alaykum. Wallahi wa barakatuh. Our ulama, our scholars have played a critical, central, even fundamental reason for us today being part of the madhab of the Ahlul Bayt alayhim as-salam. Imam Hussein alayhi salam has said, Allahumma salli ala Muhammad. Verily the path to Muslims' affairs and religious ordinances are in the hands of godly scholars who are the trustees of Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. Imam Ali alayhi salam has also said, the reward of a religious scholar is greater than the reward of a person fasting for days on end, or establishing prayers throughout the night, or even the one fighting holy wars for the sake of Allah. And when a religious scholar dies, there will appear a gap in Islam which cannot be compensated until an equal is replaced. The six scholars we will discuss over the next 2 weeks, i.e. this week and next week, and in some detail, are Sheikh Tusi, known as Sheikh of the sect, Sheikh Al-Taifa, Allama Hilli, and Allama Majlisi. And next week we will talk more about the 20th century Maraja, i.e. Abul Qasim Al-Kui, Ayatollah Muhammad Baqir As-Sadr, and Ayatollah Muhammad Sadiq As-Sadr, and we will discuss the oppression they faced and the work that they did. There are so many scholars during the period of Ghaiba that have played a critical role and a colossal role in furthering our madhab and furthering our tabligh. Like, for example, Sheikh Kulaini, the writer of Kitab al-Ka'fi, or Sheikh Suduk, whose excellent work took place, very initial work in fiqh, which is called Man La Yahdhurul Faqih, which is every man his own faqih, right at the very beginning of the Ghaiba. And in that he included over 9,000 hadith. And more recent scholars have added a great deal of intellectual work, like Sheikh Muntaza Ansari. In the 20th century alone, we have seen in our own lifetimes wonderful scholars like Ayatollah Mohsin al-Hakim, Imam Musa Sadr, and Ayatollah Khomeini, to name a few. We are really blessed, really have been blessed to have had these scholars in the presence of, in the Ghaiba of our 12th Imam, these eminent intellectuals with resilience and profound piety. Before we begin, there are some definitions up there of what we will discuss. Ulama, meaning a body of scholars. Hadith, which is a statement or actions from our Prophet or our imma. Fiqh, meaning Islamic law. Mujtahid, I want to hear, be very clear, what is a mujtahid? A mujtahid is an individual who has been recognized as having qualification to exercise ijtihad in evaluating Islamic law. Ijtihad means struggle. So a mujtahid is someone who has gone through so much struggle in understanding Islamic law such that he can provide edicts on what Islamic law should be. So for example, a mujtahid is an expert in Arabic grammar, in things like syntax, morphology, vocabulary, eloquence, etc. He is an expert in tafsir, in logic, in the science of traditions, in the science of rijal, in the principles of jurisprudence. It's a huge thing in itself. A risala is a publication of edicts by a marja. And a marja, and the difference between a marja and a mujtahid is very simple. A mujtahid is a mujtahid, but a marja is a mujtahid who has published his risala. So very, very straightforward definition there. The three we will discuss today are Sheikh Tusi, Allama Hilli, and Allama Majlisi. And the reason why I picked these three is because they're absolutely fundamental in underpinning and us understanding the role of Marja'iyah today. They have formed the framework under which today we have Marja'iyah. So, Sheikh Tusi. Sheikh Tusi's full name, as you can see, is Abu Ja'far Muhammad ibn Abtusi. And he is regarded as being the Sheikh of the sect. Absolutely huge privilege to have this title. He was born in Tus, which later became Mashhad, in 385 AH. And he started his schooling in Tus, but later traveled to Baghdad. Baghdad at the time was a center of religious learning. In fact, from Imam Ja'far Sadiq's time up until the time of Sheikh Tusi, Baghdad was a very important place, not just for Shia scholars, but for Sunni scholars, for advances in science, for advances in other things like medicine, mathematics, etc., etc. And Sheikh Tusi became a student of Sheikh Mufid, who is someone I'm sure you've all heard about. When Sheikh Mufid passed away in 1414, Sheikh Tusi then studied under Sheikh Al-Murtaza, who was the main scholar at the time, the main authority. Sheikh Murtaza is the brother of Sheikh Radi, who is the compiler of Nahjul Balagha. So at the time, Baghdad was a center of learning, and really at this point, this was what we call Shia ascendancy, because the prevalence at the time was not to attack the Shia, it was not an anti-Shia time. At that time, a lot of tabligh took place. I mean, if you look at it, places like Darul Ilm had 10,000 books. Sheikh Murtaza himself had a personal library of 80,000 books. So this was a time of Shia ascendancy. In 1436, Sheikh Murtaza passes away, and Sheikh Tusi now became the main Shia authoritative figure. And under him, there were 300 students. Now, Sheikh Tusi's gravitas is such that Sunni scholars were coming to his lectures. He attended lectures of Sunni scholars to an extent in which the Caliph gave him the chair of Al-Kalam, i.e. he became the chief scholar for the whole of Baghdad, the whole region as well. And unfortunately for Sheikh Tusi, many people became very jealous of him. They begin to really dislike him. Not only did they call him a Rafidi, a word that is not only used now, but was used back then as well, but they started attacking him. And the first attack on him was done by some of the extreme Sunni Baghdad mob, as they were called back then. They began a court case against him for speaking out against the Sahaba. And this court case was heard by the Sultan himself, who later decided that wasn't the case and overturned the case against Sheikh Tusi. But there was a big, big rise in hardline anti-Shia thinking at that stage. If we look in history, I don't want to delve into it too long, but at that point in Sheikh Tusi's life, it was the Buyid dynasty that was in charge of Baghdad. And they came after the Abbasids. So they were not anti-Shia, but not pro-Shia, not anti-Sunni, pro-Sunni. They were okay with it all. And all the very scholastic theories were taking place. But during the time, the Buyid dynasty fell apart, and in came the Seljuks. Now, the Seljuks were hardline anti-Shia, you could argue, not even Sunni, but kind of pre-Wahhabi, Wahhabistic tendencies. And they were very much against Shia. So today we talk about takfirism. When we call, let's say somebody calls a Shia kafir, we call it takfirism, right? That happened back then as well. Shia were called Rafidis, kafirs. So Sheikh Tusi himself was known by the hardline Baghdad mob and the other anti-Shia elements as being the head of the snake. So that's what they called him. And they did their very best when this change took place, when the Buyids left or lost the war and the Seljuks came, they did their best to get rid of Sheikh Tusi. So for example, they tried to assassinate him. They tried to assassinate all the top Shia elite of Baghdad. Eventually what happened was they got to Sheikh Tusi's home. Now, in a home of Sheikh Tusi, it had his library. So it was very emotional for him. He had thousands and thousands of work. And we don't have an internet age back then. We don't even have a printing age. Everything was written by hand. And they burnt down Sheikh Tusi's house. And in so doing, they burnt down his library. And this was a fundamental time for Sheikh Tusi. He lost so many original ahadith which talked about our Ahlul Bayt. And in fact, this is something that other alims since then realized. So Sheikh Tusi moved out of Baghdad. He felt that in Baghdad it was not amenable for him, and he moved to the Najaf Hawza. And Sheikh Tusi, by moving to Najaf, by moving to the presence of Imam Ali alayhi salam, was the one who founded the Najaf Hawza. Over time, his students from Baghdad came to Najaf, other students came to Najaf, and Najaf became a place for Shia learning. And today we have other places. We have, for example, Hilla, which later on we'll talk about, became a place where scholars were going. Karbala, of course, Tripoli in Lebanon, Qum. But in particular, Najaf is the one outstanding scholastic place for Shias. And I guess it fits the whole hadith, Ana Madinatul Ilm wa Aliyun Babuha. And under that blessing, under that amazing blessing, the Hawza established by Sheikh Tusi has gained massive predominance. So Sheikh Tusi, as we know, was known as Sheikh al-Taif. But why was he known as Sheikh of the sect? So he established the Hawza in Najaf. He showed us not to fight against anti-Shia sentiments, but to try to manage it through dialogue. But not only that, but Sheikh Tusi has written four of the main books of Shia ahadith. If I can ask, what are the main Sunni books of Shia ahadith? I'm sure some people will know. Any books of Sunni ahadith that we know? They begin with the word Sahih Bukhari, Sahih Muslim. It's called Sahih Sitta, right? The Sunni. What are the Shia ones called? What are the Shia books called? The main four Shia books. Always the case. It's called Kutubul Arba. Kutubul Arba. These are the four main Shia books. It's very interesting. Whenever you ask someone, what are the main Sunni books? Shias will reply, Sahih Bukhari, Sahih Muslim, etc., etc. When you ask someone, what is the main Shia books of Hadith? I don't know. And it's not our fault. It's just that the Ahlul Sunnah are proud of their books. They call it Sahih. Sahih means absolutely, absolutely the top, right? They're proud of their of this. So we have four books in Shiaism, which are called Kutubul Arba. And these four books are absolutely critical for our scholars. So you've got Kitab al-Kafi, which was written by Sheikh Kulaini, very famous book. You've got a book called Man La Yahdhurul Faqih, Sheikh Suduk, very famous book. And then you have two of these four books written by Sheikh Tusi, Tahdhib al-Ahkam and Al-Istibsar. Very, very, very important books of Ahadith. In fact, Sheikh Tusi wrote 50 books, and he's one of very few scholars to write in every single area of Islamic understanding. So he wrote in Tafsir, he wrote in Ahadith, he wrote in comparative jurisprudence, in jurisprudence. He wrote in Risala, a point that I'll come across. He wrote on Imama. He wrote on Ilmul Rijal, you know, how you look at Hadiths and see if it's authentic or not. He wrote in almost every area. 50 books in total he wrote. And what transpires in historic books is that Sheikh Tusi wasn't a stuffy scholar. He spoke in very clear language. He wrote in very easy language as well. But Sheikh Tusi, according to some people, can be regarded as the founding father of today's Marja'iyah. He did something that no other scholar had dared to do before that, is that he wrote his Risala. He wrote a Risala, which we already have looked at, is his edicts. And in the past, when people wrote Risala, for example, the Risala written by Sheikh, a Risala written in the past, so for example, Sheikh Mufid had written one, they only quoted Hadith. But Sheikh Tusi is the first one who wrote, in my opinion. Right, so he himself had started this concept of Marja'iyah, and that is why Sheikh Tusi's life is so amazing. A, he was the founder of the Najaf Hawza. I'll just continue. He's the founder of the Najaf Hawza. He moved to Najaf. He established a center. In fact, in his own house, he was teaching, and that was a very important point. In fact, in his house, if we look at his house in Najaf, it is still used today as a place of scholarship. He's buried there, but people like Ayatollah Mohsin al-Hakim have taught Dars-e Kharij there. People like, for example, Ayatollah Muhammad Baqir al-Sadr have taught there. Even today, there are scholars who are studying in Najaf. This is an example of his works, his legacy. The second legacy is when you look at the life of Sheikh Tusi, it tells you how to handle sectarian persecution. Rather than fighting back in violence, Sheikh Tusi focused on writing rebuttals and spreading Shiaism throughout the world. And lastly, his book on An-Nihaya, his Risala, was really profound. Before him, Sheikh Suduk had written Risala, but only quoted Hadith. He didn't say, in my opinion. He only gave a Hadith. But Sheikh Tusi had given his opinions and taken it forward. The important point here is, how did this concept evolve? So we have a hadith, for example, from our 12th Imam, that when our 12th Imam went into Gaiba, he told us that if you want to understand and more about religion, go to the narrators of our hadith. But over time, more important questions came across, more complex questions came across, and our scholars went to such a level that they started to be able to use the Quran, use the ahadith, use the ijma of scholars, and come across with their own edicts, with their own risala as well. The second scholar who I just want to talk a little bit about, I mean, we talked now about Sheikh Tusi and the incredibly important role he played. He was known as Sheikh of the sect. But another very important scholar, in fact, a child prodigy, is Allama Hilli. Allama Hilli was born in 648 AH in Hilla. His father was a person called Sadid al-Din al-Hilli, and his maternal uncle, i.e. his mama, is Muhakkik al-Hilli. And both Muhakkik and Allama are both known as being the first formal Maraje of the Shia world. So Muhakkik al-Hilli established the Hawza in Hilla. Again, in Baghdad, there was a lot of commotion, and for Shias, they went to Hilla at this point. Some scholars went to Hilla and established the Najaf there. This is some 200 years after Sheikh Tusi. So Hilla became a place of learning, students started to become. Muhakkik, which wasn't his real name, but was his title, means researcher, because he was very, very strong in fiqh. In fact, Muhakkik, I don't want to go into too much into this, but he even wrote an excellent book called Sharia al-Islam, i.e. about Shia fiqh, which has been publicized by Oxford and Cambridge University. But Allama Hilli is a very, very famous Shia scholar from a hugely high caliber family. I mean, he was a mujtahid, he's a marja, his uncle was a marja, his son was a mujtahid, Fakhruddin al-Muhakkik. So the whole family played an important role in Tabligh. So Allama Hilli studied under his father and his uncle, and he was really, really bright from a young age. A lot of accounts tell us that he was seen by the age of 6 as being a leading scholar. So we have accounts where people have come to Hilla and they've asked, who are the leading scholars? And there are scholars of 40-year-old and 50-year-old and 30-year-old sitting. And his uncle, Muhakkik, points at Allama and says, this person is one of the most knowledgeable people here. And interestingly, we have accounts to say that he became a mujtahid by the age of 11. Incredible, absolutely incredible. And he had between 500 to 1,000 students. So he is a child prodigy. At the age of 6, for someone to understand Quran, to understand the grammar, to understand how it works, to understand ahadith, to understand the consensus of scholars, to come up with his own edicts, absolutely unbelievable. We also have stories where Allama Hilli is a child at the end of the day and has some childish jokes. And there's one that I came across which I thought was quite funny. Allama Hilli was in trouble with his uncle Muhakkik because he played a prank on him. So Allama ran away. We call him Allama, but he's still a 6-year-old. He ran away from Muhakkik, and Muhakkik is chasing him down the street. And as Muhakkik is chasing him, he gets very, very close to Allama and nearly grabs him. And Allama, to stop Muhakkik grabbing him, recites the verse of sujood in Quran. So Muhakkik, Allama is not baligh at this age. Muhakkik has no choice but to recite and do the sajda while Allama runs away. And this happened a few times, and Muhakkik just realized that he was also, he had a naughty side to him as well. So he became a marja when his uncle passed away. Muhakkik passed away in 676. And at that time, Allama was 28 years old. So he becomes a mujtahid at 11, but he becomes the grand Shia authority at the age of 28. And he was the marja for 50 years. But not only did he study under his father and his uncle, he also interestingly studied under his brother-in-law. So good luck to him there. But he also studied under Ali bin Tawus and Ahmad bin Tawus and other very, very well-known scholars. The interesting thing is when you research Allama Hilli, he didn't study just under Shias. He also studied under Shafi'i scholars and other Sunni scholars. There's one account where it could be argued he was even doing taqiyah at a stage in Baghdad. So he had gone from Hilla back to Baghdad to learn about Sunnism and to study under Sunni scholars. So he had also learned under Shafi'i scholars in particular. Allama Hilli was also a very strong mathematician and a very strong scientist as well, and there's accounts of him studying about science. It's unimaginable that someone so young was able to pick up such material. He became a strong writer. He wrote almost 500 works. There's one interesting story here, which is why many people call Allama Hilli the founder of Shiaism in Iran. If you remember in Iran, in Iran at that time, had a sultan called Sultan Muhammad, known as Khudabanda. And he was the king of Iran, but he was open to all types of Muslims, non-Muslims, all sorts. And he had his court, and in that court he had 4 main scholars, a Hanafi, a Shafi, a Hanbali, and a Maliki. And, everything comes with this issue. He had several wives, and the most beautiful was the one that he loved the most, but he argued with the most as well. At one point, he must have argued with her so bitterly that he gave her he divorced her thrice, which is the Sunni way of, talaq, 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 thrice. He is divorced her. Now he became very upset. When he cooled and he calmed down, he realized in his anger he had divorced the most beautiful wife that he was most in love with. So this was a very, very big issue for the Sultan at the time. So he gathered his court and he invited the Hanbali and the Hanafi and the Maliki and the Shafi'i to come. And all 4 came and he asked them all, now what do I do? I've given this talaq apparently to my wife. I've said divorce, divorce, divorce. Now what do I do? Interestingly, the Hanbali and the Hanafi and the Maliki and the Shafi'i, all 4 gave him the same answer. That now that you've divorced your wife, she is formally divorced, she has to remarry, she has to consummate, then she has to divorce, and then she has to remarry you. So naturally, he was very upset. The thought is quite frightening. So in essence for him, this issue became really personal. He had apparently, in his eyes, divorced his wife, and now to come around, there was something that was impossible. So he was really upset. Luckily for him, someone shouted, "These aren't the only sects of Islam. There are also the Shias." You should see the reaction now of the Hanbalis and the Hanafis and the Malikis and the Shafis, because they said, "Ah, but these are the Rafida, the rejectors." The word comes again. Not only in the time of Sheikh Tusi, not only in today's time, also in the time of Allama Hilli as well. But the Sultan needed a solution. So he said, no, where are these people? So somebody said, in Hilla. And they were looking for Muhakkik al-Hilli. So he said, okay, let's go. Let's take a delegation there. Let's bring back their main scholar. Let's again have this court. And let's have a decision as to whether my marriage is void or valid. So the delegation went, and by the time they went, Muhakkik al-Hilli was no more, and Allama Hilli was the marja. The issue was, the king said, if I don't get a decision my way, I will execute the person as well. So it was very interesting. They got to Hilla. They asked Allama Hilli whether he would go to Iran or not. At this point, Allama Hilli thought of it as an opportunity to spread Shiaism in a non-Shia country. So he agreed, despite the people around him telling him not to. So he went to Iran, and the Sultan explained to him, Khudabanda as his name is, or his nickname is, explained to him that, look, I did this divorce thrice, etc., etc. So Allama Hilli now narrates a hadith of Imam Ali alayhi salam, in which he explains to him that actually the marriage is still valid. Sultan becomes very happy. This is excellent news. But the Hanbalis, the Shafis, the Malikis, and the Shafis, Malikis, Hanbalis, the four jurists say, actually, this is a Rafidi sect. Cannot accept this judgment. This judgment is void. Interestingly, now the Sultan allows a debate to happen. And a debate occurs between one representative of the Sunni and one representative of the Shia. When Allama Hilli first came to the court itself, he did something very weird. He didn't take his shoes off. He took his shoes and put it under his armpit. And he walked straight in and sat next to the Sultan. So the Hanbali and Hanafi and Shafi and Malik, they're saying, well, how has he done this? He hasn't paid respect and taken off his shoes. Allama Hilli's reply is very funny. He says, actually, I didn't take my shoes off because in the Prophet's time, when a person took his shoes off, the Hanbali stole the shoes. The Hanbali said, how could that be possible? Hanbal came so many years after the Prophet. Not possible. He said, Allama Hilli said, no, actually, it was the Shafi. My mistake, I've forgotten. So he says, so the Shafi'i stole. The Shafi'i scholar says, but Shafi was after the Prophet. Then he says, no, it was the Maliki, and so on and so forth. In the end, Allama Hilli says, no, actually it wasn't. But Sultan, you can see from what they're saying that their jurisprudence comes much after the Holy Prophet. Now listen to me, my jurisprudence comes from Nabuwa and Wilaya of Imam Ali alayhi salam. So Allama Hilli has this debate now with the scholars on the other side, and the debate lasts a number of days. The person representing them is called Nizam al-Din. He's the one representing the four scholars. Allama Hilli debates them, long debate, goes on and on. Sultan's attention is not even there. It goes on and on. But in the end, Nizam al-Din, the opponent of Allama Hilli, accepts that we are not Rafidi. He explains that this is a sect, and there are very, very, very valid points on Allama Hilli's side. So he doesn't himself pronounce himself a Shia, but he allows Allama Hilli's presence to be there. The Sultan was absolutely delighted because it justified the fact that his divorce is not valid. And in essence, he promoted Allama Hilli immediately, giving him the Friday sermon, giving him rights to propagate. And Allama Hilli used this opportunity to push Shiaism into Iran. His works are on the screen. I don't want to go into too much detail on his works. Allama Hilli did almost 500. Some people say 500, some accounts say 500, some accounts say 1,000. But a lot of work was done by Allama Hilli. You can read the summary there. The one I want to focus on is Minhajul Karama. Allama Hilli wrote a number of books about the importance of Imamah. And in one of his books, he wrote Minhajul Karama. And in that, he spent the parts on Imamat. His first two chapters were Imamat and the Reasons, chapter 3 on Imam Ali's qualities, chapter 4 about the proof of Imam Ali's Imamat, chapter 5 rejecting the ones who politically put themselves before Imam Ali, and part 6 he rejected the succession of Abu Bakr. When Allama Mahili wrote this book, news spread like wildfire. And these Sunni scholars were very, very, very upset that an important book in favor of Shiaism was written by Allama Mahili. So the Sunnis around Arabia decided to go to the most anti-Shia scholar that existed at the time. And that is Sheikh Ibn Taymiyyah, who is regarded by many now as the father of Wahhabism, father of ISIS, father of extremism, etc., etc. And he wrote Minhaj al-Sunnah. So you had Allama Hilli, who wrote about Imamah, and then you have Sheikh Taymiyyah, who writes about the importance of Abu Bakr. And in essence, how he does it is, in the first part, he writes about the superiority, put bright inverted commas, of Abu Bakr. And secondly, he puts down Imam Ali. And this book, Minhaj al-Sunnah, if anyone reads it, it's available in a lot of bookshops. It's even in English PDF online. It is a very vehemently anti-Shia book. We are known as Takfiris, compared to Christians and Jews, to be killed, etc., etc. And in this, Sheikh Ibn Taymiyyah just purely rejects a number of amazing ahadith. You know, Ana Madinatul Imwalim. All of these are all rejected. In fact, he comes up with other hadith, sometimes seen for the first time. He says, Imam Ali intended to marry Bibi Fatima so as to hurt her on purpose. He said there is disagreement about whether Imam Ali had memorized the whole Quran. He even suggests that Imam Ali was drinking. So this is as far as the anti-Shia sentiment was there at the time. If we're looking at today's world, where there's so much anti-Shia feeling in Yemen and Pakistan, Iraq, it was also back there as well. And the way our scholars managed it was through writing, through works, through advocating the importance of Imamah and Wilayah and these concepts. So Ibn Taymiyyah, you know, was discarded. Allama Hilli wrote further works to discard his work. And Ibn Taymiyyah even had an interesting akidah. So he said, Ibn Taymiyyah, I don't want to spend too much time on him, but just to show you what type of scholar was opposing Allama Hilli, he says, Ibn Taymiyyah says, you can physically see Allah in the hereafter. He has a face. He talks. You can hear him. He has a throne on which he sits. He has hands, including fingers. So this was the akidah of those opposing our Ahlul Bayt, alayhim as-salam. There's so many works that were done by Allama Hilli. Shahid al-Thalith records in his Majalis al-Mu'mineen that one night during the Taqiyya period, or during the period when Allama Hilli was in Baghdad as a youngster, he managed to get hold of an anti-Shia book. Now, the teacher, it reads in the account, the teacher is actually, the person who wrote the anti-Shia book happens to be his teacher, hence the conclusion about Taqiyya, although we're not 100% sure. So he got hold of this book. It's approximately 1,000 pages. And his teacher says, you only have one night to read the book. I want it back in the morning. So Allama Hilli gets this 1,000-page book and begins to copy it. There's no Microsoft Word, computers, typewriters, nothing. He's simply copying out the book. And interestingly, and Shahid al-Thalith says this in his book, and various other narrators say this, a man appears, an Arab man appears, and sits next to Allama Hilli. And he also helps Allama Hilli write the book. And he tells Allama Hilli, you read it out, I'll write it. Or I think more to the point, it's something like, you give me the essence and I will write it. And this person is writing the book. And by Fajr time, the entire 1,000 odd pages has been written. So Allama Hilli is startled as to who this man is. As he turns around, the man is no longer there. And our historians, our commentators say that this can only be our 12th Imam, alayhi salam. So Allama Hilli's legacy is that he brought Shiaism to Iran. In an era where Shia was known as Rafidas, rejectors, and much other stuff, in an era where anti-Shia ahadith were being spread, Allama Hilli, through using the Sultan's invitation, brought Shiaism to Iran. Secondly, his other legacy are his works. Some huge number of works were undertaken in many areas, in philosophy, in imamat, in fiqh, etc., etc. And we talked about how his importance of his book, Minhaj al-Karama, was, and the reaction from the enemies of the Ahl al-Bayt. And thirdly, he is the first scholar to define the concept of ijtihad. In that, in his definition, he says, ijtihad is putting in the utmost effort in acquiring the knowledge of the laws of the Sharia. So he writes a book on this. And you can argue that Muhakkik al-Hilli and Allama al-Hilli are the first formal maraji of the Shia world. It is later developed by Shahid Thani, Allama Majlisi, etc., etc. But this was a really important part in the development on the concept of marja'iyah. The third scholar and the last scholar for tonight that we will look at is Allama Majlisi. I'm sure we've heard a lot about Allama Hilli in the past from a member, and Allama Majlisi as well. And it'd be useful to know a bit more about him as a background. Mujan Momin, who is a more contemporary writer, says, Allama Majlisi was one of the most powerful and one of the most influential Shia ulama of the time, whose policies, whose actions reorientated the Ishnashri faith into the direction that it has since followed. Allama Majlisi was born in Isfahan, which was the capital of Iran at that point, in 1616, to a pious scholarly family. His grandfather was a Mullah Maqsood Ali and was very well known. His uncle was a Grand Maharaja, Mullah Abdullah Shustri, and his father was also a very well known Mujtahid, Mullah Muhammad Taqi Majlisi, or as historians call him, Majlisi the First. And it's very well documented, the story of the birth of Allama Majlisi. There was a friend of the father, friend of Majlisi the First, who was coming back from Mashhad, the shrine of our 8th Imam, back to Isfahan. And along the way, he had a dream. And in that dream, there is a baby which is born. And there are two people who are praying over it. This person who had the dream feels it was the Prophet and Imam Ali praying over this baby. And they're praying that this baby does tabligh and plays a pivotal role in the development of the Shia school. And in that, interestingly, he's given rose water petal to drink. So he remembers this very, very well. He then comes to Isfahan and he goes to the house of his friend, Majlisi the First, and he finds out that a baby is born. And then he is given this rose petal water to drink. So he connects the baby in his dream to the baby that he then sees. And Mullah Muhammad Taqi Majlisi the First, prayed a lot for his son to do tabligh. He was always praying for it. There's so many accounts of him praying for him to become a wonderful marja, a wonderful muballigh, a wonderful ulama, a alim. And Majlisi the First himself did huge amounts of propagation work. At the time, it was the Safavids who had took over Iran. And they were mainly Sufis. They mainly came from a Sufi order. And you could see that they were practicing a bit of Sufism, a bit of Shiaism where it suited them. There wasn't any clear demarcation between the two. So Allama Majlisi began religious education at the age of 4. Interestingly, his brothers were ahead of him, Mullah Aziz, Mullah Abdullah. His sister was a scholar, Amina Begum. His brother-in-law was a scholar, Mullah Swaleh Mazandarani. So his whole family was made up of scholarly work. And Allama Majlisi again was very impressive. Again, by the age of 11, he was regarded by Mullah Sadra, who was his teacher of philosophy, regarded as an excellent scholar. We're not sure of the age in which he becomes a marja, but we know by the age of 21, he became a mujtahid, another wonderful mujtahid at such a young age. In terms of his works, you can see it on the screen, and he did a lot of works. So his first concept when he began was to go into philosophy, but he realized when you look at the life of people like Sheikh Tusi and the fact that original ahadith was going missing and stolen and destroyed and burnt, that his life should be dedicated to gathering ahadith. So he was appointed as the Sheikh al-Islam by Sultan Shah Safawi. He spent a lot of time on philosophy, but most of his time was dedicated to gathering ahadith. And the one important book that he got was the book we always hear about from the minbar, which is Biharul Anwar, which is the largest compendium, the largest encyclopedia of Shia ahadith, 110 volumes, each of multiple pages that have been gathered. When he was writing in his preface, he writes, Allama Majlisi writes, I searched in the east and I searched in the west, and whenever I got any information about a book of hadith or any ahadith, I would try to get it at any cost. We reached every city, every hamlet, and with Allah's grace, we gathered such important information. Imam Khomeini writes about Biharul Anwar. He writes, Biharul Anwar is the work of a great scholar of ahadith, Muhammad Baqir al-Majlisi, which contains nearly 400 books and treaties. Biharul Anwar is itself, and the author who wrote it, an ocean of ahadith. He did this because he was scared that it would be lost and wasted after him. Interestingly, 100 or so years after Muhammad Baqir al-Majlisi, the Safavids are destroyed, original hadith work is destroyed, but his book survived. So alhamdulillah, his mission of writing Biharul Anwar survived. He'd written a number of books. I've listed them there. In total, 100 books were written in 73 years. You can just imagine when we say this, how difficult and cumbersome it is. There is no word processor. There's no typewriter. Books are written by hand. Just imagine an error. You have to go back and rewrite the whole page. So someone to write 100 books, or someone like Allama Hilli to write 500 works, different works, is a huge amount of tabligh. So Allama Hilli's legacy, in short, was the wonderful book of Bihar al-Anwar. This is his biggest and most amazing legacy. His second one is the development of Ijtihad. He was a well-known marja, he was a grand marja. He issued many fatwa, he answered very complicated concepts. And thirdly, very importantly, he steered the population away from Sufism to Shiaism. And he created a clear demarcation between Sufiistic orders and Shiite Nasharism. And the difference is quite big, but at the time was very mixed. So to conclude, and I know today is a little bit more drier than next week, where we have interesting stories from Saddam, we have stories of torture, etc. But these three scholars have played an incredibly important role in where we are today. Their work and their prestige, their intellectual strength, the fact that they were child prodigies, the huge contribution, the huge number of works that they have done for the madhab of our Ahlul Bayt alayhi salam, has been amazing. Their role is paramount. Their legacy is ever continuing. We are really fortunate to have had these level of scholars in the period of Ghaiba. Look at Sheikh Tusi and his books, his roles in forming the Hawza of Najaf, his concept of developing Ijtihad. Look at the life of Allama Hilli, making Iran, or becoming the first one to make Iran Shia, to, you know, becoming the first formalized marja, spreading knowledge through his many works. And then look at the wonderful life of Allama Hilli and the wonderful book of Bihar al-Anwar. Every Thursday we remember Imam Hussein. And there's one story of Allama Hilli which is accounted many, many a times, and the connection of our 12th Imam to our 3rd Imam. Allama Hilli has written in his book, Tazkirat al-Fuqaha, that if one person visits Imam Hussein's shrine on a Thursday night for 40 consecutive nights, then they will have the ability to meet our 12th Imam. And he was doing this. He was on his 39th night. He would go from Hilla to Karbala. So he had done it 39 times. On his 40th time, he was on his mule going from Hilla to Karbala. And he was joined by a man, and he had a number of dialogues with this man. And he asked this man very complicated fiqh questions. And this man would tell him, well, go and have a look in this book by Sheikh Tusi, and you'll find this answer. One of the questions he then asked him was, he asked this individual, well, why do you think that there are ahadith which say that when you cry for Imam Hussein, all your sins are forgiven? So this man gives an excellent answer. He says, imagine a king who had gone to the jungle and fought in the jungle, or had gone to the jungle for hunting, and he became very thirsty and he had no one left. And then he finds a woman, an old woman, who only has one possession, which is a sheep. He takes the sheep for him to eat. What would be, he's asking Allama Hilli a legal question, what would be the reward for that woman from the king? The king will go back to his kingdom, but the woman will have lost everything she had. So what is the equivalent that you would give to the woman? So Allama Majli is saying you cannot give anything. Even if the king gave his entire kingdom, it wouldn't be equivalent, because she has given everything he had. So this person says to Allama Hilli, what about Imam Hussein? When he has given everything he had, do you not feel that Allah will give him jaza and anything that Imam Hussein wants? So that is why crying for Imam Hussein is of such huge significance, and why Imam Hussein is of such critical importance for us today, that his shafa, his crying alone can be shafa for us. And let us look very quickly at the sacrifice of Imam Hussein. Imam Hussein left Medina, and from Medina he was pushed to Makkah, and from Makkah he was pushed out of Makkah and had to go to Karbala. When he came to Karbala on the seventh day, they didn't give him any food, any water. He was all alone. What sacrifice did Imam Hussein give? What sacrifice did his companions like Habib ibn Muzahir and Jean give? What did his family give? Look at Onan Muhammad and the sacrifice they give. Look at Qasim and the way his body was trampled. Look at Akbar, the way his spear went into him, and the fact that Imam Hussein didn't have the strength and he had to say, Ya Ali Madad, and look towards Najaf as he took this. Look at Hazrat Abbas and the two arms of Hazrat Abbas. Look at the sacrifice of Ali Asghar and eventually the sacrifice of Imam Hussein. In fact, even when Imam Hussein is gone, the sacrifice continues. Bibi Sakina and the ears or earrings of Bibi Sakina and the slaps on Bibi Zainab and the fact that they continue to take her hijab away and then to Kufa and Kufa to Sham. Imam Hussein has given such sacrifice. That is why our 12th Imam has said that whoever cries for Imam Hussein, his sins are forgiven. Tonight, let us remember Marhum Muallim Mustafa Mauji, who wrote a huge number of articles on all our ulama. I remember receiving his articles by email on all our ulama, from Allama Tabattabai, Allama Hilli, Allama Majlisi, so many of them, Sheikh Mufid. He would always write an article and send it. Let us remember him with Surah Al-Fatiha. Tonight is the Sharwat-e-Shadi Majlis of Ali Tharu to Fatima Pir Muhammad. Let us remember the families of the two, the couple, the marhumin of their families with Surah Fatiha.